Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sibby Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Laurie R. King about her latest novel, Back to the Garden. Laurie R. King is perhaps best known as the author of a series of books featuring Mary Russell and her partner-slash-husband, Sherlock Holmes. Indeed, I interviewed her about that series back in 2013, not long after the release of Garment of Shadows, the 12th Russell Holmes mystery. But she has also written other books, historical and contemporary, series and standalones. Back to the Garden uses a dual timeline format to counterpose a present-day investigation to events that unfolded 50 years earlier. The juxtaposition of past and present proves to be a particularly compelling presentation for this long-buried, quote, cold case, unquote, murder. The novel begins in the 1970s. Then, Southern Oregon. The man in the dripping army poncho paused to shove back his hood and stand, head cocked, trying to make out the half-heard sound. A minute later, a car came into view, half a mile or so down the hill, a big white Pontiac, struggling to keep on the road. The man leaned on his shovel, judging the contest between the treacherous surface, the way up to the commune was unpaved, rutted, steep, and slick with the endless rain, and the determined car, which obviously had good tires. The car slithered and flirted with disaster, but managed to avoid going off the edge or getting bogged down in the section where the culvert had washed out last month. When it came to the end of the clear section and vanished behind the trees, the man bent over to shake the rain from his long hair and beard, like a dog coming out of a river, then slopped the last shovelfuls of mud from the block ditch before walking down to see what the invader wanted. And now, please join me in welcoming Laurie R. King.
Hi, Laurie. I look forward to talking with you again.
Hi, Carolyn.
People who would like to hear more about Russell and Holmes can do that by listening to our earlier conversation, which they can find by searching for your name at newbooksnetwork.com. As I mentioned in my introduction, a standalone contemporary is certainly not a departure for you. But what inspired this particular story?
Oh, I think a lot of us changed plans when the world closed in on us, didn't we? All that travel that I had on my books of, oh, well, I need to research the next Russell and Holmes in France and south of France and Paris. And no, not so much. So I started looking at some other ideas that I'd kind of been playing with, including I always wanted to write a book set in my youth of the 60s or 70s, because it, you know, it's really an interesting time, and it's more or less historical now. I mean, they sort of, I'm amused when reviewers and such categorize Back to the Garden as being historical, because, hey, I was there. That can't be that historical, right? So, but I wanted to write one of those interesting two-timeline books of a cold case. And that's where it came from, is a modern-day investigator with the San Francisco Police Department named Raquel Lang and her investigation of bones that turn up that came from the 1970s.
I have to phrase this question carefully to avoid giving away too much. Who are the man in the army poncho and his visitor? They certainly don't seem to move in the same world.
Yeah, it's always a puzzle with a writer whether or not to put in a prologue. I mean, it's usually a distraction. On the other hand, it's occasionally really necessary. And I decided that a prologue here was one of those necessary bits because without it, you aren't told where the focus is on the stories that you're coming across, because there's two or three chapters that are brief, that are the main characters, that are, they're related, but you don't find out how. But I wanted to have something that shows this is what we're headed towards. And so that's what the prologue, that's the function the prologue serves here. So that both of the characters that you see in there are the then timeline, which is the 1970s. The man in the army poncho is a Vietnam vet named Rob Gardner. And the man who appears in his very, very muddy front driveway is a poor young lawyer from California named Jerry, who is sent up to tell him that his grandfather has died. So the two of them are indeed from different worlds.
That prologue ends with a great line, as the old bastard finally died. We turn the page and immediately flip forward into the present with another great line. The day had been going so well until the bones turned up. We'll get back to the old bastard in a moment, but give us a context for the bones. Who is Jen and where is she when the bones are found?
The bones are found, and we have to tread carefully here without spoilers. The bones are found when an estate that is open to the public, a garden and manor house that is open to the public in Northern California, is doing some renovation work on an oversized statue that was put up during the 70s, during the then timeline. And when it is shifted in order to repair the foundations, there are bones. So that's where they come from.
Well, that certainly would ruin anyone's day, I think. Who is Jen?
Jen is the manager of this estate, the Gardner Estate on the San Francisco Peninsula. She's a woman who lived in the neighborhood when she was growing up. She knew the area when she was a kid, and she's been hired to put the estate in some kind of order, which is particularly tough during and after the COVID times because things are shut. And so this is when the world is starting to open up again. I don't know that it gives a specific year for that now timeline, but it's roughly now. So that's who Jen is.
So we have a beautiful arboretum nearby where my husband and I like to go walk on the weekends. And so that's sort of my mental image of the Gardner Estate. But how would you describe the estate itself?
It is, for those who know the San Francisco Peninsula, the Gardner Estate is roughly very, very loosely based on Filoli. Filoli is a manor house that was built in the 20s and 30s. It has a formal garden. It has land around it. It's kind of located roughly where the Gardner, the fictional Gardner Estate is, but it's not that the house, the gardens, the land are different. This is a fictionalization, but it's kind of that thing. It's a big house that was built by people, the Gardner family, who wanted a place to entertain the important folks of both California and the United States in their bid to become important forces in the political and artistic world of the 30s and 40s and 50s. So that's what the estate is now in the book. Now it is a open to the public, and you can see the gardens and so forth.
You mentioned that the bones are found under a statue, so I won't ask you more about that. But the statue is in the book, the creation of a woman named Miriam Gatto, and there's a wonderful line about her menacing feminist phase. I'm assuming, in my artistic historical ignorance, that Miriam Gatto is a fictional character. What inspired her?
Yeah, and unfortunately, her original name in the book was somebody who actually was an artist, so I had to change it from Dado to Gatto. I wanted somebody who was the kind of in-your-face feminist that you would find in that period. I mean, Judy Chicago's work, and I don't know if you know the Guerrilla Girls, Guerrilla, G-E-U-R. They were a sort of feminist collective artists who did a lot of politically tinged work in this time period. But there were so many male bad boys of the time that I wanted this one to be the female equivalent bad boy. So that's who Miriam Gatto is.
And what is her menacing feminist phase? I mean, how does she express it in art?
Well, I think we've all seen art by people that is definitely intended to offend. I mean, there's nothing like a cow cut in half and suspended in formaldehyde to make you sort of rear back from the display, is there? And there's a lot of stuff that especially men would be really, really menaced by. And that's what Miriam Gatto is known for in this book, is things that are in your face female with no apologies.
Yes, I have to tell you that the tripartite statue that is at the center of the story, and I don't know if you want to go into that or if that's something you'd like readers to find out, it certainly stopped me in my tracks. I was like, oh my God, I'd have nightmares about this thing.
Yeah, it's there's three-faced gods from India. There are some three-faced goddesses, but they're not as well known as the three-faced god. And each one of those faces has to do with a divine attribute of creation and life and destruction. And so Miriam Gatto, in this sculpture of hers, has these three faces. But because of circumstances, it has had the menacing, the threatening, the death side of the statue facing out for all these years. And nobody quite realizes what the back two faces look like because they're growing up right next to a very tall hedge. So that's part of the revelation of the thing. When they move the face, not only do the bones come to light, but the other two faces come to light.
So I think we should probably leave that there because it does become important as we go forward. So after we've encountered Jen and the estate, we next meet an old man who's on the brink of death, shackled to a hospital bed, and Inspector Raquel Lang, whom you mentioned, who is staring at a wall hung with 4 8.5 by 11 inch photographs. This is still in chapter 2, so we're not giving away spoilers yet. So do please tell us a bit about the photographs and what they mean to Raquel, and I'll leave it to you to decide how much you want listeners to hear about the old man.
Well, the old man, I think you discover fairly early on that he is a suspect in the murders of these women whose photographs Raquel Lang is looking at. And Lang is an interesting character because she's, if I do say so myself. she's very cold and analytical, and yet she is moved by these victims in a very profound way, and becomes extremely committed to finding out whether this man that they suspect has done it, or whether it's someone else, and whether they're the bones under that statue that came to light. So that's the central plot of the book there. But it, as you say, chapter two, I mean, it's not giving an awful lot away. It's in the public excerpt on my webpage. So no surprises.
So tell us more about Raquel. As you say, she's a very interesting character. I found her quite compelling. And she has quite a history of her own as a detective. So introduce her to us and explain how she ended up in the cold cases department.
Yeah, and it's one of those areas that I don't want to step too firmly into, because spoilers. But you gradually get the idea that Raquel has a considerable backstory that may or may not have an impact on how she works and what she's doing in the cold cases department. But she has been seconded to the cold case unit because of an injury, apparently. She's using a cane when we first meet her. And Jen, whose eyes you see her first through, thinks that it might not be a permanent part of her, the cane, but more a temporary, that is, from an injury rather than a long-term thing. And she has become a part of the cold case unit while her injury is getting better and while some kind of thing is going on in the background to decide her future. But again, without getting into that too much. So that's what she's doing in cold cases. She's fairly new to it, but it's something that she's quite suited to.
I was thinking more of her personality, her particular skills as a detective.
Yeah, she's, as I said, she's pretty cold and analytical. In some ways, she's kind of a modern-day Sherlock Holmes, in that she is much more interested in the problem than in the people around it. Her mind sees details that other people don't, and that's not always conducive to close friendships with other people around her. and so that's, you know, I mean, she has friends, she has family, but not a lot of them. And I think that's fairly apparent from the first time you see her.
Yes, it really is. So let's move on to the gardeners. And here I'm just asking you to give us like character sketches of them, just so people know who they are without going into the details of the plot. So let's start with the old bastard. Who was he and what did he do to acquire this epithet?
Well, he was something of a bastard. There are four generations of Thaddeus Gardeners, the first, the second, the third, and the fourth. The first was the one who kind of started the family, who definitely started the family fortune and somewhat started the family estate. But the second one, Thaddeus Gardner the second, finished the estate, married a woman who had a lot of ambition. His mother had a lot of ambition. And the two of them set up so that his son would become a political force. And the problem was that his son was not interested in being a political force. So the Thaddeus Gardner II, it's all clear in the book, I think, Thaddeus Gardner II, focuses his attention and his determination to become a political force on his two grandsons, who are Thaddeus Gardner IV, who is known as Fort, and Rob Gardner, who you meet in the first chapter of the book, though not necessarily by name other than through Jerry's mouth. But he is not a friendly person. He is not a warm and grandfatherly sort of person. He is someone that creates a lot of turmoil and pushback from his grandsons, and so they just flat out call him the old bastard.
So how does Rob come to host a hippie commune at the family estate? Since this is one of the really fun parts of the book.
It's fun to write that kind of thing. Rob Gardner comes back from Vietnam in 1972. He ends up on a hippie commune in Oregon in the mid-70s. When he inherits the estate, he makes it into a commune with his Oregon commune. They move south. And that's the sort of basis of the community that has set up there. I think you like Rob Gardner. He's obviously got problems, but he's somebody that his fellows on the commune generally like him, although they don't necessarily approve of him because he comes from money. So he's obviously got issues, but you figure that his heart is in the right place, maybe. So that's Rob.
And for those of us not of our generation who may not have a clear sense of what a hippie commune was like, can you give them a quick description of life at this particular commune?
You know, it's really interesting that the 70s were this kind of interim period, weren't they? In the 60s, under the impetus of the war in Vietnam, you had this widespread movement of rejecting all the things that the establishment valued, so that, you know, the normal jobs with benefits, retirement pay, all the things that you look for now, were to be put in a heap and burned. Anti-war, back to the earth, natural, all the rest of it. And the 60s were also a time when the pill became available. So sex was something that was accessible for people without as many consequences. And AIDS was not a thing yet. So you had this period where it was natural to be open and free. So all of these things came together, and people decided that they wanted to change how the world worked. They wanted to embrace the things that really mattered, the earth, each other, preserving the natural way. And we had this back to the earth movement where we from top to bottom, reconsidered values and reconsidered what was really important. So for a few years, you had these communes that sprang up where everything was held communally, and where people tried to be responsible towards each other and towards the earth. And of course, many of them just fell apart because you have human nature, and there's always somebody who knows how to do something, period, and doesn't want to do it the way others want to. You also have questions about how you raise your kids. I mean, that was a big part of why communes tended to drift away, because what are my personal responsibilities towards my children, as opposed to the commune's responsibilities towards them? And often that was different. So you had this period in the 70s where all the communal living experiments that had sprung up all over, and especially on the West Coast, in California and Oregon and such, were re-examining how they could keep it together. And, you know, the realities of money and drugs and children and responsibilities and growing your own food is not easy, were making them question whether this was really the way to do it. So you see the commune in this book in that stage of, here's this lovely Back to the Earth family that has these goals and ideals and wants to do things the right way, coming up nose to nose with the reality of who owns what and how do you vote on how it's controlled. The communes were a lovely time, but they weren't exactly realistic.
No, as has been repeatedly discovered throughout history.
Yeah, you know,
it's hard to control people who are less inclined to work or more inclined to work, or people who get jealous, or people who want their kids to have a full education, which they don't have the skills to give them, and all of that kind of thing. I mean, all of those
questions enter into the story. Is, and what do we do? What are the two parents of the three kids? Are they supposed to turn their kids' future over to people who are more interested in smoking dope in the trailers?
Right, exactly. So several of the commune members do emerge as distinct personalities, Meadow in particular. Could you tell us a bit about her as a personality?
Oh, I love Meadow. She had such fun with Meadow. Yeah, Meadow is, I think it describes her in there as something like a hippie earth mother with the political skills of a Chicago mayor.
Yes.
Because, like I said, you know, human nature differs, and skills and abilities and preferences differ. And someone who moved in a commune in the mid-70s, might have been a woman executive with the padded shoulder, the shoulder pads that were popular in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
that was what feminists were doing in the 80s, was moving into the boardroom. And of course, they thought they might, but they ended up taking notes and bringing coffee. But yeah, that's another story. But Meadow is one of those whose abilities and way of dealing with things make her a leader, even in a group that denies that anyone should lead. So it's one of those ironies of a group of people, is that, sure, theoretically in a commune everyone has equal word, but in fact you always have someone who actually does things.
and that's
Meadow.
That is Meadow. I love Meadow too. I thought she was a great addition to the story. Annabelle is another person in the commune who eventually captures Raquel's interest. What can you tell us about her?
Well, again, in a commune, you're going to have lost souls. And Annabelle is one of those. She shows up because she's pregnant. She's been thrown out by her conservative family. And she becomes a part of the commune. But she's the sort of person that everyone feels that they should protect, because she doesn't she doesn't have much sense and much much sense of self-preservation. But she's obviously a sweetie, and everyone sort of shelters her and takes care of her small son and the rest of it. So she is the voice of the other kind of, the other part of the commune. That, you know, Meadow is one of those people who get stuff done, and Annabelle is one of those people who wanders around and is given a job to do and happily does it.
Well, you can't be a captain if you don't have people to do your bidding. So.
Right.
She needs Meadow, yeah. And Meadow needs her.
And then you have people, you know, like you have this kind of pothead who wanders around, and he's actually still around in the now part of it. Who's, you know, Raquel has to agree that he's obviously someone who sort of took too many heavy duty substances back in the day, and they just kind of wanders around and doesn't get much done, but is functioning sort of.
So I don't want to push you into areas where you're not comfortable giving away information. So I'll ask you, are there other characters or incidents that you would especially like listeners to hear about?
Well, you know, one of the things, other than these ones that we've been talking about, one of the things I really, really liked about this book, and one of the reasons I set it in the 70s rather than the 60s, was that I could do the now sections of it in modern day and have a bunch of people with gray hair who were nonetheless you know, really interesting, vibrant, active people. I don't know about you, but my hair is pretty gray. But the people that I know who are in their 70s and 80s are all extremely on their feet and active. I mean, we have aches and pains, but we're very far from finished with life. And I wanted to bring some of those in. So you have some of them who are there as witnesses, some of them who are there as suspects. And I liked being able to work with my generation both in the past and in the present. So I think, you know, the books that have old people as being Miss Marple knitting and thinking about things, I don't know too many Miss Marples. The 80-year-olds I know run 3 days a week up in the hills. And that's the kind of 80-year-olds that you'll find in this story.
What would you like people to take away from Back to the Garden?
it's always a question, isn't it, of what do you take away from any story? And I think that the author is probably the last person to know what impact a story is going to have on people. I like to think that people will find something entertaining, and I like to think that Back to the Garden and all of its characters are just that. But I also like to play with ideas that are, that are more or less between the lines, because the kinds of novels, especially mystery novels, crime novels, that feel like they're written standing on a soapbox preaching, they don't appeal to me. I find I tend not to finish them. But I love the ones that have a subversive thread to them. And I love it when I can work in the kinds of ideas that get in there. One of those in this is the idea of, in this day and age of, you know, defunding the police and reallocating city and government funds, are we justified in spending police money on looking at a crime that is half a century old? And, you know, the amount of impact that's going to have, if, for example, you find an 80-year-old is guilty of this, what difference is that going to make if he's in a hospital bed, for example, and he's dying? Or if he's in his 80s and by the time any trial is finished, he won't have that much left of his life. What difference does it make to spend money on a cold case? And I think that's something that is interesting to me as a challenge with the writer, is making the characters important enough to a reader that they say, yes, of course it matters, even if they couldn't say exactly why. But, you know, there's a lot of other things that go on in the book. That's just one of those interesting little tidbits that I think about when I'm reading something like this.
That's a really interesting point, though. I'm glad that you raised it. The author's note at the back says that you're currently working on Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes' 18th adventure. I guess this is the one that got delayed because of COVID. Can you drop us a few hints about that? Is that progressing now?
I'm doing the research for it. I'm doing the background, not the travel research, but the book research. And I think it's going to incorporate a lot about the backstory of Sherlock Holmes himself. And if you think about Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes character, you don't know anything about it, really. You know that he has a brother. You kind of are vaguely aware that he has a family because he comes from a, you know, country squire, as he calls them. His grandmother was the sister of the artist René. But he doesn't even say which artist René, and there's four generations of them. So I'm playing with some interesting ideas for that.
Well, I look forward to reading
that. As far as it's, I think it'll be fun.
And will we see Raquel Lang again someday? Because I'd love to make her reacquaintance.
Yes.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm already playing with ideas for that. The next, Back to the Garden is out in September of 2022. The next Russell and Holmes will be out in February of 2024, so 15 months on. So the 2025 book will be another Raquel Lang.
Well, there's nothing like planning ahead, so that's great.
You know, it's really weird, isn't it? You think, and it's like you make these dates on your calendar and you think, I can't even think of what the world is going to look like in 2025.
Right. Especially the way things have been going, my gosh.
I know. Would you have thought 3 years ago that what we look like today?
No, not in the least. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Laurie. It's been a pleasure.
Carolyn, it's been a joy. I wish you all kinds of good readings and have a lovely year.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Laurie R. King about Back to the Garden. Find out more about her at laurierking.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Network. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.